You were recommended to help run the last leg of the relay that began with Adam and Eve because your premortal spiritual valor indicated you would have the courage and the determination to face the world at its worst, to do combat with the evil one during his heyday, and in spite of it all, to be fearless in building the kingdom of God. You simply must understand this, because you were born to lead.
My name is Kirk Franco. I'm the host and creator of Lead With Yes. Really, I'm the guy that gets to have all the fun and interview interesting people. Today is another segment of How I Lead, where we find the most interesting and experienced leaders, whether they think so or not, and interview them about their leadership experience in the church, ways they approach problems, and study their solutions to those problems, and hopefully we can take away something that we can apply to our own leadership. So today we have Mary Wilson on the phone with us, and she is from Puyallup, Washington, which is in the Seattle area. She's a two-time, kind of sounds weird when I say that way, but a two-time Relief Society president. She was just released recently and has interesting experience there. Works for, contracted through Boeing in the IT arena. And Mary, I'm happy to have you on the podcast. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate you having me.
Good. Well, now, have you, tell me a little bit about your journey to Washington. Have you always lived there? Were you raised there?
I was raised in Cody, Wyoming, as was my husband. I'm the oldest of 12 kids in a Catholic family. And I joined the church when my husband and I were married. And I'm the only member of the church in my family.
Oh, wow.
So we, as we grew up, we didn't know each other, but I did babysit for my husband's sister for a while.
Okay.
And that's how I met him. And after we were married, we went to school at BYU, and that's where we received our education, our college education.
Okay, now, so was he raised in the church then?
He was raised in the church, but he was inactive from about the age of 15 or 16 until we were married.
Oh, cool. And so with the 12 kids in the family, you're still the only member of the church, right?
Correct.
Okay. So how did your, obviously you could probably go on and on about your conversion story, but was it your husband's family that first introduced you to the gospel and showed you the way to join?
You know, as I look back on it, I had a lot of questions growing up that never seemed to be answered to my satisfaction in the Catholic faith. I was raised by great parents who taught sound moral principles. But when my husband and I became engaged to be married, we decided that we wanted to raise our children in one faith. And so we decided we would investigate each other's faith. And, of course, my husband was inactive at the time, and I was Catholic. And so we ended up taking classes in both faiths. And we ended up in a temple prep class.
Oh, wow.
For the LDS Church, unbeknownst to us. But that was the class somehow we ended up in. And it answered all my questions. So I had decided that I wanted to join the church. So we were married in the Catholic Church, and 3 months later, my husband baptized me, and then a year later, we were sealed in the Salt Lake Temple.
Oh, cool. So when you were married in the Catholic Church, you had it was with the understanding that you were going to be joining the church?
Well, that was my husband and my understanding.
Yeah, you didn't advertise it at that point, so... Okay, cool. Now, from there, you and your husband went to BYU, and you have quite the resume of education. You went on to get a PhD in leadership research and policy. Maybe tell us a little about your educational background.
Okay. We both hold bachelor's and master's degrees in design engineering from BYU. BYU is one of the first universities in the nation to undertake a curriculum in computer graphics, and that's kind of where we started when it was very new. Now it's everywhere, and it's all you see. And then in time, I received a PhD from the University of Colorado in leadership research and policy, and that's a degree that encompasses, it's in the College of Education at the University of Colorado, mm-hmm. but it encompasses many different avenues, and all kinds of people were in our cohorts, including people in the military. We, of course, had educators. We had people from the prison systems. We had people, other engineers like myself. And so it's a degree that I felt I could use to help me really in my church callings, as well as in the things that I do in my work, in my everyday work.
Ah, perfect. And definitely want to hear how you've applied some of those principles from your education to your various leadership callings in the church. So after you were married, baptized, did you have a pretty traditional LDS family upbringing with your children? And
well, I think so, because my husband had been inactive, and I was new to the faith. It was trial like error, like I suppose it is with
sure.
Your parents. But we raised four kids, and they've all been very successful. We homeschooled. I homeschooled for 14 years, and the kids did very well with that. In fact, both our boys had master's degrees before they went on their missions at 19.
Whoa. Wow. So how does that work exactly? They started college courses a little bit earlier than somebody in public school?
They did. They have a program here in Washington, or it was fairly new then, and I think other states around the nation have it now, but it's called Running Start, and they were able to complete their high school courses and their first 2 years of college at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So they ended up graduating from high school and graduating from college the same, or with their associates the same week, and then went on to a four-year university here mm-hmm. locally.
Wow.
They all went to different universities for their masters, and one of them has a law degree from BYU, and the other three have master's degrees from University of Utah, University of Washington, and Vanderbilt.
Wow. Sounds like that's quite the feat, but that's impressive. I've never heard of anybody go on their mission at 19 with a master's degree, so that's impressive. So now, what stage of life are you at now? Your kids have moved on, and you and your husband live in Washington together?
We do. We call ourselves transitional empty nesters. We love it and we hate it at the same time.
Oh yeah.
So it's a new phase of life for us, and
okay.
None of our kids live here, and so we miss them and our five grandkids a lot.
Okay. Now, is your I think you told me before, is your husband currently serving as bishop right now?
No, he's been released.
Okay,
he's been
released.
Both in Colorado Springs.
Oh, okay. Great. So, how long ago was your first time being called as Relief Society president?
Well, I guess that would be about 7 years ago.
Okay. And how did that come to be? Maybe tell a brief story about how you were called.
Okay. The first time I was called, I was a gospel doctrine teacher at the time. And the bishop set up an appointment, came to my house, and we chatted for a while. I knew he wasn't there just to chat. He eventually got around to asking if I would accept the call to be a Relief Society president, and I said I would, as long as he'd take care of my gospel doctrine class. I'd really grown to love them, and I love teaching, and so he did that, and I became the Relief Society president.
Okay. Any intuition beforehand that was coming, or did it surprise you?
I had some feeling that things were changing. I didn't, I guess, expect to be called exactly to that. You never quite know. Mm-hmm. But I knew things were in flux, and things would change for me.
Okay. And how long did you serve the first time around?
About 2.5 years.
2.5 years? Okay. And then the interesting story you told me before we started to record is that you were then called as a society again when your husband was the bishop, and through the direction of the stake president. Maybe tell us that story of how that came to be and how you were called there.
Well, I was again teaching gospel doctrine in the ward, so I don't know if that's like a stepping stone or something. I don't know, but we had a very transient ward that we lived in, and so there was lots of people moving in and out, lots of young families, and so I suppose in his discussion with the state president, that's how that instruction was given. And so he came home from his meeting with the state president, and he fixed dinner that night, and then and then asked me if I would accept that call.
So he just casually snuck it in there during the dinner conversation?
Yeah, so it was, yes. I knew something was up, though.
Okay. Okay. And that was the same ward that you served the first time, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a great ward, and lots of wonderful people. Like I said, it's a transient ward. We had lots of military folks in and out, and it's a great ward, though.
Cool. So usually the demographics and the nature of the ward will impact the different decisions you make, where, you know, you would make a completely different decision if you were in a different type of ward with a different demographic. So maybe elaborate on just what the demographic was like, or the nature of that ward was like during your time as serving as Relief Society president.
Well, when we first moved into the ward, there were quite a few less children in the primary, and so it was a little bit older ward. But over just a few years, it gradually became more younger families with young children. And it was in a demographic, I wouldn't say, you know, particularly low income, but certainly not high. We had a number of military families, and so there would be some deployments that we had to deal with, and sisters that would be left home with children while their husbands were deployed. And we even had a sister or two that was deployed during that time that we served.
Wow.
So, and that's a tough thing. That's a tough thing for families. And it definitely makes you pay attention a little bit to what's happening with home and visiting teaching with those families, making sure that their needs are met. And some do better with those deployments than others, and some have more needs than others. So
yeah,
being aware of those kinds of things. We had a number of elderly members as well that we needed to take care of. And so I think it was a pretty normal ward in terms of activity and callings and people, doing the work that we're instructed to do.
Okay, and was the transient nature of the ward just due to the fact that of the military influence
there?
It
was that, and I think people living in some apartments that then purchase a home and, make a better condition for themselves, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Some job changes when the market switched, and kind of we had that downturn in 2008, lasted for a few years. There were people that were affected by that.
Yeah.
It caused some of them to have to leave, and others that moved in for the same reason.
Okay. And being a Relief Society president in the same ward, a few years apart, were there any obvious differences that you experienced from each time that stood out more than others?
I think I learned things the first time through that I applied the second time through. I think I tried to be a better leader the second time through. I think I tried to listen to people more, and it was definitely a different experience in the fact that a lot of the visits that we made, that I would make on behalf of the Relief Society, the bishop would go as well. So my husband and I would visit people together.
Yeah.
And so that was a little bit different than my first experience. So they were both, I learned things from both experiences, and I think I grew from that. Hopefully, I did the things the Lord wanted me to do both times.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is an interesting dynamic. It would be odd to most bishops to go visit people just with their Relief Society president. But I guess if she's your wife, you might as well. It seems like it makes sense.
Right. And it worked really well for us. And it also gave us the time really to spend together that we might not have otherwise had.
Yeah, good point. So during your time as Relief Society president, you mentioned to me this concept of leading by example. Obviously, it's a concept we all strive to do. What are some examples or ways that you tried to lead by example?
Well, I've always loved the quote from Carlos E. Acey that says, "You bear your testimony best by how you live." And I think, you know, just going through the normal day-to-day activities and living your testimony. If, you know, there's places that you need to strengthen it, then you try to live that better each day. I don't ask anyone to do things that I'm not willing to do myself. For instance, if I want my visiting teachers to commit to 100% visiting teaching, then I model that by doing that myself.
Okay.
There's, you know, it's not to do things so that other people see you do them. I don't think that's
right.
The concept. I think it's just doing everything you can to be true to your own self and to what you know.
Sure. And then, you know, with the Relief Society, I don't know if this is just by nature, this is how this comes up more in Relief Society, but obviously the church has a high standard for, you know, living the commandments and choosing the right and always pushing us to become more, which is good, but sometimes that can go to an extreme measure where suddenly it switches from encouragement to discouragement where you feel like you're faltering again and again, and this happens a lot with leadership when you are tasked with a role that has so many responsibilities and so many things to do and so many balls that are in the air and you do your best not to let them drop. So how did you, with all you were tasked to do and all that the sisters in your Relief Society were encouraged to do, how did you teach that concept of basically doing all that you can do but not beat yourself, you know, when you don't?
Well, I think that is a hard concept, and it's easy to cross that line. I think you have to be aware every day of doing the things that the Lord would have you do, and exercising your agency in doing that, and allowing other people to exercise theirs. And I've actually had that conversation with a couple of people. And with my presidency, it was my most recent one, we're never going to do it all. It's impossible to achieve everything. To get to the end of the day, or even, you know, after so many years in a calling, you know, if you were there for 5 or 10 years and feel like, well, I accomplished everything I wanted to do, there's always a way to improve. There's always something more to be done.
Yeah.
So instead of letting that discourage you, and this is a concept I actually learned from Sherry Dew, and she calls it the art of selective neglect. She said, well, some days you own 30 buildings, and they're all on fire, but you only have one fire truck. So what building, Lord, would you like me to save today, and where should I spend my energy today?
Perfect.
I think, you know, it's really realizing and keeping your eye on the big picture and not get so mired down in a lot of the details sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's great advice for incoming leaders in certain callings because, you know, you've been, it's an honor to be trusted with such responsibility, and you want to do a good job, and then so you have high hopes, and then as you go through it, you can become discouraged very quickly when you suddenly realize, wow, this is harder than I expected. Maybe the last, you know, leader wasn't so bad at what they were doing, even though from our outside perspective, we feel that way sometimes. And I love that concept, the art of selective neglect, that sometimes, you know, as with the analogy, some buildings just burn down because you just can't do it all. And a lot of the times, those buildings that burn down are very valid buildings that you think every other leader would probably make time for, but you didn't, you know, so it's tough to move past that, but you're only mortal.
And I think in helping those that work with you, you know, I look at it as a teaming thing, you know.
Yep.
My counselors, my secretary, they're my team, and we work together on these things, and we just, none of us have the time, energy, or resources to provide everything. None of us do in whatever calling we're in. I don't think the prophet or the apostles
Yeah.
even have all the time, energy, and resource that they want to do everything they want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a purposeful thing. I think the Lord wants us to come to Him to say, what would you have us do?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, if the church was created by man, it would almost make sense to, instead of just have one quorum of the 12 apostles, why not have, you know, every country in the world have a quorum of the 12 apostles so that those special witnesses could get out there. But there's different ways that the Lord has to accomplish that, and to use the members and the local, you know, authorities and so forth to get the message out there. So makes sense.
Well, that's so true. And I think it's important, too, for, you know, your predecessors to realize, you know, and for the person in the current role, it's not that they didn't do a good job. They did. They did a great job. They did what they were supposed to do during that period of time. And then, you know, you're called, and as soon as you're called, that's the next day is your march towards your release. There's very few callings that don't have a release. And so, you know, do the best you can. Build on what's been done. And, you know, hopefully see some progress that way.
Yeah. Yeah, just make sure you keep moving the football down the field, for sure.
We're all in it together, so I don't see any reason to, you know, say that anybody didn't do a good job. How do we know that?
Right.
We don't know what their conversations with the Lord were.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you mentioned predecessors, and it makes me think of another question I want to ask you, so I'm going to just sneak it in here. But being recently released, and now you've been released twice as the Relief Society president, what was the transition like to the new Relief Society president? How did you do that as effectively as possible so they felt confident in their new calling as the president, and they felt confident moving forward, like we said, moving that football further down the field?
Well, I think it's important to sit down with the new president and go over what you felt were your successes and where you would have liked to have done better, where you struggled. It's good for them to know that maybe they can help with some of the weak areas that I had. They can build on those. I think it's important that they know that the baton is passed, so to speak, in terms of what families are struggling and need help, and offer, you know, anytime you need help or have questions, don't hesitate to call me.
Yeah. Perfect. And now going back to some of the advice that you would have for incoming Relief Society presidents, or if you could go back in time to talk to yourself when you were first put in, you mentioned this concept of conflict resolution. Obviously, in any organization, there's going to be some disagreement or misunderstanding that arises, and sometimes a leader needs to step in just to be a third party and help resolve that. Any specific experiences that would be appropriate to tell about that principle?
Well, I guess there's a couple of points here, a couple of things. One is to realize that there's a difference between conflict and contention. The contention comes from a very different influence. Conflict resolution is a skill, and I've even heard at conference a couple of different times where the apostles have talked about, you know, a conflict that they might have had between themselves. And it's about the conflict between ideas and not people. And they have conflict, but not contention. And they work together till they understand what the Spirit wants them to do in unanimity. So that is a concept we can learn from. How do we resolve conflicts so that they don't become contentious? And ward council, for instance, is composed of a lot of people with differing opinions. But when we come into a ward conference or ward council and follow that pattern that the brethren have set, then we can be united to do what the Lord wants us to do. Then a resolution is usually found much quicker than if it becomes contentious. So I think being aware of that in any kind of a meeting with leaders, because they were chosen to be leaders, they have gifts and talents that they're going to bring to that, and sometimes it's the listening skill is very involved in this, so that you can listen and understand with your spiritual ears. Rather than, just ideas that you feel like, oh, I can't even agree with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I don't mean to project my experience on yours, but I've noticed that in the church and the culture of a ward, a lot of the time that conflict, when conflicts arise, they're very silent conflicts behind the scenes where, it's nobody's screaming at another person in the hall. It's more of there's an offense made, and one person is slowly phasing out of activity, and suddenly you are wondering where they go, and you're not even aware that a conflict is even present there. Is that your experience from time to time?
Well, from time to time there is, and there are people. I mean, and you and I both know that there's a high percentage of inactivity in many wards, and a lot of that is, or not all of it, but there is some that people have taken offense or been offended for one reason or another. And you need to try to draw them out. And I've found that going to them one-on-one is a better way to do that. We've had people come back to church because we've gone to them one-to-one, and said, how can we help? What offended you? How can we help get that resolved?
Yeah.
And then doing what you need to do. Now, wrapped up in all of that is the concept that you're not going to please all the people all the time.
Yep.
And when you try to do that, you end up trying to please the Lord without offending the devil. So there are some things that you cannot compromise on, and you have to draw a line in the sand. They're not negotiable, but we do that in a very loving way. Try to get them to see where that line is and why it is where it's at, and then invite them to be on the Lord's side of the line. And sometimes that means you have to, reach across that line and help them take those steps to get back on the Lord's side of the line.
Yeah, perfect. Just I could relate that to, or what came to my mind is in the October 2014 conference, Elder Robbins talked about, which way do you face that? Are we messengers from our members to the Lord, or messengers of the Lord to the members? And that's a good paradigm shift to have in order to realize that no, we are messengers of the Lord to the people, called in these capacities. And two things that are really one thing that I wanted to highlight that you mentioned is this concept of going to these individuals one to one is crucial. Now, with that, the other important thing you said is that conflict resolution is a skill. You are not magically ordained with this power to be this therapist that can resolve any conflict they face, and you just know exactly what to say. A lot of the times, I know as a leader, I say some pretty dumb things when I'm trying to fix a problem because I'm just, I need more practice. I need to be a little more articulate. And so understanding and looking for resources to approach this situation, because there's probably a lot of leaders out there that are just shaking in their boots when they hear that I have to go to this person's house and I have to talk to them, like that's going to be so awkward and I don't know what am I going to say. And so it really is a skill that takes practice and pondering and preparation in order to do it effectively.
Well, it does, and it's something you've got to practice. You can role play that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there's lots of good books out there on conflict resolution, and I think there's even a few talks by the general authorities that you can pull up off of LDS.org. But it is a skill, and the important thing is it can be directed by the Spirit.
Perfect.
Teaching people how to do that and giving them, you know, so that they're not afraid. And, you know, you might mess up. You might go and you might say things that you didn't mean to say. You know, we all need to apologize.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing for a lot of people. But, you know, once you do it and if it's heartfelt, it just mends a lot of fences and it helps people on both sides of it.
Yeah, I think that's great when you say, you know, sometimes you mess up. And going back to the Sister Dew's analogy of the burning building, sometimes you take your fire truck to the building and you end up lighting the next building on fire next door. And you're thinking, man, what did I do? You know, I keep messing things up. And that's truly where the grace of Jesus Christ comes in. It covers those mistakes too. You know, you did your best as a leader and you just have to leave it there and say, well, I tried, now it's worse, but maybe I'll have another opportunity that the Lord will provide in order to get both the buildings to stop burning.
Well, and I think, you know, wrapped up in that too, and probably it is the foundational principle in conflict resolution is understanding the atonement. When we understand that and we can rely on the atonement, that becomes an easier skill. And one of the other callings that I had was as a leadership consultant in the ward. And once a month I would go into ward council and I would use about 15 minutes of time to teach a leadership principle, give them some ideas on how they can use it and some resources. And I think that helped our ward council be stronger from within, because those aren't skills that we take time to teach people very often.
Perfect. And so going back to that, so your bishop would have you take 15 minutes of ward council to kind of have a training moment? Oh, okay. Oh, once a month. Okay. Cool. That's great.
It was, I felt like it was very beneficial. I had good feedback from the council members, and I asked them. I had them actually do a survey the very first time, so I knew where were they struggling. And, you know, the elders' quorum president would have different struggles than the primary president, just because of the nature of the people they're working with.
Yeah.
And the skill set that they had. So we were able to help different people with different things, and hopefully all benefited from that. That's my hope. But I did have good feedback from people on it.
Yeah, you know, and this is probably a whole other podcast that we can discuss about this, but I love that idea of taking some time during ward council to have a training and, you know, sharpen your saw, per se, and helping people learn, develop leadership skills, because we kind of get in that meeting and say, okay, who do you want to talk about first, or what problem do we need to solve now? And it reminds me, just this past Sunday, I had ward council, and I went in there and I said, we're gonna start a little different. I turned on a BYU devotional speech by Dan Clark that he gave back on September 30th, and it was more of a, you know, he's a professional motivational speaker, so it was kind of uplifting and it was funny, and we watched that for a half hour, and I just said, you know, I just don't want you to get discouraged that we come in here and try and solve problems that we talked about the last 6 months. And so let's just work on ourselves and focus on that. And I got great feedback, people saying, ah, that was great. You know, they came to the meeting kind of thinking, like, what more can we talk about to fix this issue or help this family? And obviously we got to those points, but I think that's fantastic of just taking some time and sharpening the saw, because a lot of leaders don't have that time to do that.
Well, and a lot of people get called because that's where the Lord wants them to serve.
Yeah.
But they might not have the skill set that they feel like they need to do their calling. So it was a way to give them some extra tools in their box to use in magnifying their own calling.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. Now, another point you mentioned is following the brethren. Obviously, in a relief society calling, as we've learned in recent conferences about, you know, you're working under the keys and authority of the bishop. What was your experience in having to follow the brethren and make sure that was the line to follow?
Well, for me, General Conference is like Christmas. So I get Christmas three times a year, which is great. because I really truly feel I'm given great gifts during that conference time. So I always try to take a reflective period of time after conference and figure out what is it they're asking us to do. Where do we need to step up to the plate a little more? What things do we need to quit doing? Where does our focus need to be? And I think that informs our work at the ward level. For instance, let's take just this very last general conference that we just had. I think there were threads running through almost every talk to strengthen ourselves from within, to hasten the work within our homes and our personal lives and our ward families among the active membership, as well as those we're sharing the gospel with. So there, you know, there was this thread about, you know, hasten the work with your own personal development. At least that was
yeah.
One of the I got from it.
Yeah, sure.
So then I would take that concept, and I would, if I were in that position of a leader position, I would take that concept and say, okay, how does that inform what I'm doing? How does that change what we're doing in our Relief Society enrichment meetings? Shall not call it that anymore.
Sure.
Our Relief Society meetings. You know, how does that inform how we're teaching? How does that inform how we're visiting and what messages and help we need to give to our sisters in their homes? And so I think that comes out of every conference.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of Thomas S. Monson said, I think it was on October 2008, he said that the opportunities come and then they're gone. And he said, I believe that among the greatest lessons we're to learn in this short sojourn upon the earth are lessons that help us distinguish between what's important and what is not.
Yeah.
And I think if we look at that focus and we take these talks from the brethren and follow their counsel, it informs everything that we're doing. Because they're getting those messages from the Lord.
Perfect.
So we're doing what the Lord wants us to do if we're following them and keeping our eyes on what they're doing.
Yeah. You know, and that keeps going back, kind of the thread going throughout this podcast episode is that, again, that art of selective neglect, that making sure the message we have are the important ones, and the way we can know what the important ones is going back to our leaders, our general leaders, and understanding the topics they're bringing up, because obviously with prophets, seers, and revelators, it's important to listen to that. So, the last point you put on here, again, goes back to this, the same topic of, striving for excellence and not perfection. Maybe expound on that.
For a long time, I really struggled with perfectionism. But I in time, and again through the power of the atonement, I came to understand that striving for excellence helps me grow faster than striving for perfectionism. And only the Savior and our Heavenly Father are perfect. And so even though they're my examples, I have to strive to give my very best to my endeavors and to do the best I can at this point in time. Now, it might not be as good as I'll be in a year or in 2 years or even tomorrow, but it's the best I can do today. And instead of beating myself up because I'm not perfect, I can have joy in the fact that I did a little better than I did yesterday. And so I'm striving for that excellence.
Perfect. Now, generally, one thing I want to accomplish with these How I Lead segments is sometimes I'll come across two leaders, maybe in a more secular setting, that they discover they're both serving in a similar calling, and they'll start comparing notes about meetings and when they have meetings and how they approach those meetings. So over your time serving as Relief Society president, what was the most effective typical week look like from Monday to Sunday? What meetings did you have and why?
As far as a Relief Society president, we had two ward councils a month that I attended, and I only held a presidency meeting once a month. We have enough technology available to us that I didn't feel, and we were well organized enough. Usually my very first meeting that I have with the Relief Society president, see, lasts about 3 hours. But in that meeting, I go over, you know, kind of what my vision is and you know, how I feel about working together and how we do that. I think it was Richard G. Scott said, you know, a lot of people are just trying to get the water down to the end of the row when we should just let it rain. And so, you know, getting out of the way of the Lord, basically, and doing the work. So after that, a monthly meeting seemed to suffice where we could plan what we needed to do. We could take care of and attend to the needs that we had for sisters. If things came up, we have smartphones, we have iPads, we have email, we have texting, we have all kinds of resources that we can rely on to communicate and to without taking people away from their families any more than we needed to.
Yeah.
So in terms of my formal meetings for Relief Society, that's what we had. We, of course, would have stake trainings and different things like that we would attend. And the rest of the time, we spent primarily visiting members in the ward or spending time with families that were ill or in the hospital or, you know, different things that were going on with them. So it was really a week-to-week thing and what are the ward's needs now? And during the time my husband was a bishop, we had things like bishop's youth discussions, so we had time to plan those kinds of things and really start incorporating the youth into a lot of these same ideas and helping them get some leadership skills because they are the future leaders of the church.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you mentioned a little bit about using and leveraging technology so that we can be around family as much as possible. Any specific technologies you use to expedite the process of being the president?
You know, I mostly use the general tools that we all use, Microsoft Office, email, texting, any resources we can through the LDS.org, like the calendar. We didn't have really too much in the way of document sharing or anything like that to use Google Docs or, you know, those types of resources.
Yeah.
Most everything we could accomplish by email that way.
Okay. Great. Now, the holy grail of all questions when it comes to leadership in the church is visiting teaching. This is a constant problem that leaders try and figure out, and I guess I shouldn't label it a problem. It's an inspired program that really works, but sometimes, again, that we go back and set our expectation as perfection, and it should just be excellence. So what was any unique approach to visiting teaching, and how did you handle that, what you learned from managing that process?
Well, we did a couple of things differently, and we found that I know they have visiting teaching coordinators in a lot of wards, but we found people were not really willing to open up to them and pass information to them that would then get passed to the presidency. Mm-hmm. So we kind of eliminated that layer of management, if you will. And I had, we divided the routes up between myself and my two counselors. And so that the visiting teachers were reporting directly to one of the counselors or myself. That seemed to make people feel a little more comfortable with sharing some of their difficulties where they knew they could get immediate attention. I also asked those counselors and myself to make sure that third of the ward that they had a stewardship over for visiting teaching, that every one of those sisters was contacted during the month. I want to know what the needs of those sisters were. Where are they struggling? Why weren't they visited by the person that they were assigned to? So we tried to look at it as we want to make sure everybody's visited, not because we care about the numbers, but because we care about the sisters. The numbers will take care of themselves.
Yeah, perfect. You know, serving as a leader in the church and such a valid and strong focus, and you know the message of the gospel of Jesus Christ is so motivating. You know, you have some pretty incredible experiences, especially as you said, working with the one and, you know, one-to-one and watching over those sisters that you preside over. And so as you were serving those times, how would you best describe how you became a better disciple of Jesus Christ during that service?
Well, I think those opportunities, and they're not lacking. Just, you know, I guess I want to stress that you don't have to be a Relief Society president to have these experiences or to be able to help the one. We do have more opportunity sometimes in those positions to be his hands, to help in rescuing that one. But I think being in those positions helped me build my faith and my testimony, and to trust that he would give me the answers that I needed when I needed him to help someone else. And I think I became much more aware, you know, on a much bigger scale. And part of this had to do with, I got to sit in a number of seminars with Julie Beck when she was the General Relief Society president, and I learned a great deal from her about how to serve. But everyone has a story, and the Lord loves everyone regardless of what that story is, and he wants them to be part of his kingdom. So how do I be that kind of influence that can help those people or give that kind of example? Not always perfect at it, still learning that. I think in being a disciple of Christ, I think you have to understand the adversary is real too. So the more you strive to become a disciple of Christ, the stronger that influence sometimes can be in people's lives. And he's real. But understanding that the Lord's influence is greater, that his influence is more powerful, and if we use that and do what he would have us do, we're going to grow. And I think for me overall, the awareness of all that and all that goes on in running a ward, my being a better disciple lightens the load by one person, or at least lightens it a little bit.
This concludes the interview with Sister Mary Wilson. I loved how she said at the end that you do not need to be Relief Society president to have these experiences. It is so true, you know, that these miracles and experiences are found in simply serving. It takes no title or ordination to experience just the love and that comes through service. So I appreciated her saying that. Again, I appreciate you tuning in and listening to these episodes. And one thing you can do to kind of help spread this message and get these great interviews in the in the iPods across the world of Relief Society presidents, Elders Quorum presidents, bishops, any leader, is to take this episode and share it on your social media streams, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and share the message and get this out there, and hopefully more will tune in as we continue to find leaders who will share their experience. And I've really benefited from doing these interviews, and I hope you've benefited from listening. Thanks again.